All right, last That's a Dive of the season. I'm getting emotional a bit. I got PJ with me. This is it, the last Tad part of the season.
I know, you just came back, I feel like.
I know, I just got here. Really? I'm like some of these coaches in the Premier League that were hired at the end of the season to save the club. And
it feels like
fired.
David Moyes just came to West Ham and now he's gone already.
Oh, man. The good thing is we know that we're hired back for next year. Even if we get relegated, we have a job for life. We're Tad Potters for life.
We're a little more fortunate than Premier League managers.
We are, because no one pays us, so no one's really worried. No one's really worried if we do good or we stink. But you guys have been continually sending these reviews and telling us that we're good, even if you're lying, and we love you for it. So let's start again with reviews. This one comes from Mr. Wizzle. He said, my one player would be Buffon, who, by the way, you may still get a chance to play with. I don't know how good you are, Mr. Wizzle, but Buffon might be going to PSG, I heard, which would be strange because he'd be a number two. I mean, I guess most, I don't know. I mean, I guess most places he'd go, if he's going to a big club, he's going to be a number two. I mean, he's 40, isn't he?
I think he's going to be 41 by next season. So,
yeah,
that seems like a strange move for PSG.
If it wasn't Juventus, I mean, he's still Buffon, even though he doesn't. I mean, I guess where he benefits is part of his great characteristics of a goalkeeper hasn't always been based on athletic ability. He's a great athlete, but he's got this incredible wingspan. I mean, he's got that kind of Van de Sar, like lanky, great goalie frame and positional awareness and experience. I mean, he won't let you know that he can't really get off of his feet and explode to the corners anymore. Yeah. But God, Buffon is so good. Mm-hmm. So good. And you just love him. I mean, he's one of those guys where, like, he just looks like someone you just want to be on his team. Mm-hmm. You just want to be around him. I love him, and I'm going to miss him. There's so many. I actually tweeted that out today. I'm having a harder time with some of these legends retiring than my own career ending at 28. I mean, to think of, you know, just over the years, I remember when Zidane announced I was distraught when Zidane still, I mean, what was he? He was just 30,
like 33,
right?
33, I think. I
thought he was younger. I think he stopped playing when he was like around 30. I might be wrong. But I remember
he definitely was. I remember thinking he was. He still.
I remember thinking, he definitely.
He was 34 by the time he retired after that World Cup in 2006.
Oh,
He turned 34 during that World Cup in 2006.
I guess I just thought he was still at the height of his game,
there was no drop off.
Yeah, and the way he went out with that headbutt and everything, it was not the way you wanted to see Zidane walk away. But you know, Pirlo recently, I saw his testimonial, Kaká. You know, Iniesta's not retiring, but retiring from Barcelona. Like, I mean, it feels like he's walking away from the game.
Same with Buffon, too. Even if Buffon plays again, even if it's PSG or even a big club, it doesn't feel like it's over.
Yeah. It's kind of like with Arsene Wenger and Sir Alex Ferguson. I mean, the era of the kind of quote-unquote one-club manager or someone who just embodies and encapsulates and is synonymous with the club. I mean, the player version of that's kind of going too, right? You know, I mean, like Stevie G, I guess, and you'd say Totti and Iniesta and Buffon. It's sad, man. But we have a World Cup. We have a lot of things to get us out of this depression. We'll get to that because that's going to be one of our topics today. The next topic is going to be the merry-go-round of Premier League managers, who's coming, who's going, what is happening, and then the FA Cup. So that was the last, you know, Premier League, quote-unquote Premier League game of the season. Highly anticipated. It was Jose against his old club. It was Conte, I guess, a dead man walking, it seems, trying to go out with a bang, trying to salvage some, I guess you could say, respect. But I can't imagine anyone has lost respect for Conte, knowing that Chelsea has this habit of, especially recently, of just
basically
ebbs and flows and
entire,
peaks and valleys.
The entire Abramovich era.
Yeah.
You expect these managers only going to last a couple years at most.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's worked, right? Mm-hmm. If you're going to be critical of that, I think it's like 10 different permanent managers in the Abramovich area and like 15 trophies. I mean, it's definitely churning out silverware. But this was a big game because, you know, Jose Mourinho... you have to say progressing Manchester United in terms of, I mean, second place finish. You can't, and no one's more critical of Jose than I am, it seems. I mean, I'm all over this guy. You have to give him credit for moving this club as the second best. Now, you could unpack that and you know, move the table aside and the points and find ways to be critical. But you have to start by saying this was a club in turmoil. I mean, this was a club that, even if you don't like the style that Manchester United are, and I don't, I find them difficult to watch, it was worse under Louis van Gaal. I mean, it is moving, at least, you know, stylistically, moving it forward a bit. Second place finish, you know, Europa League trophy, getting to another cup final, although, you know, you never see it. That's his first domestic cup loss, right? I mean, that's his first loss, in England in a cup final.
Yeah, I think that might be right, yeah.
So, you know, this was a big game for him, because that would have been another one for Manchester United fans, for sure, to shut people like me up and say, you know, second place FA Cup, you know, Kyle, keep going with your criticism. But I'm going to keep going with my criticism, because they lost. And what was remarkable about the loss was, and this is just peak Jose Mourinho. Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing. After the game, he criticizes Chelsea for their approach, an approach that Jose Mourinho uses all the time, especially in cup finals, an approach he used against basically a bunch of teenagers in the Europa League final against Ajax less than a year ago, how short his memory is that now Chelsea don't deserve to win it, and all this criticism of them afterwards. It was just remarkable. I mean, the problem with Jose's media magic trick is it only works, right? It's predicated on success. The only way he can have these barbs, the only way he can be that idiosyncratic, you know, love him, hate him, incredible version of Jose Mourinho is if there are trophies propping it up. I mean, no trophies, nothing this year. So the second place finish, miles off of Manchester City, and then stylistically, something that's not easy to go to Old Trafford and watch against West Brom and other teams, them struggle to break teams down or sit back in a defensive shell when they should be attacking. Or, you know, the Theatre Dreams over the years has been known for producing great Manchester United teams that, you know, at least like risk and are willing to take risk. I think sometimes people think Sir Alex Ferguson was this like go fly forward team, and they weren't. There's a bit of revisionist history there. But this was a big match for the narrative, right? Because now going into a season that we're in unprecedented territory. Jose Mourinho's never been at a club without winning the title in the second, at least the second season. He hasn't stayed with a club past the third season, I believe, although I think that maybe that happened once where he made it into a fourth season. But, I mean, typically third season is the collapse. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the, we've won a title, everything falls apart, pick a star player to attack, and, you know, we've seen the formula. So it begs the question, what Manchester United are we going to see next year? And I'm staying with my position. It's not going to be a title winning team. Ultimately, the reason they hired Jose Mourinho, I can understand. I don't have the emotional side of being a Manchester United fan that obviously is driving them to overlook the shortcomings and overlook the cons of hiring a guy like Jose Mourinho toward the back end of a very, very successful career to say, listen, we just want to win again. You got that, check. That happened in the first season. It doesn't matter. It was sort of second-tier trophies. Did that the first season. Wanted to battle for titles again. I mean, didn't battle, but no one did. Yeah. Second place, got to give him that. But here's the issue. Recruitment hasn't been great. Pogba still, I mean, that's the star player that we expect there to be a major. And I don't buy any of the, you know, kumbaya, everything's okay. You know, Didier Deschamps said that publicly when Pogba comes to France, he's happy, and he does. He looks happy. He looks better there, and he said he can't be happy at Manchester United. It doesn't seem like he is. And then Lindelof, you know, struggling. Bailly, frozen out of the team. I'm sorry, frozen out of the team because the argument was he was trying to set up Smalling and Jones to make the World Cup squad. You know, Smalling misses out on the World Cup squad. Yeah. You know who he didn't try to set up to make the World Cup squad who missed out as well was Martial. So Martial not going to a World Cup with France.
You could argue Mata too, I guess.
Yeah, and with Martial, he's better at left has been better off of the left side than Alexis has been recently. Mm. And Alexis isn't going to World Cup. So why would you play Alexis, who's not going to a World Cup?
Yeah, if you're using the World Cup.
If you're using that excuse. Yeah. So he's up to his old tricks. The problem is, like, you know, the shine is worn off, where now it's just with Manchester City showing what's possible in the Premier League, playing the total football style. There have been counterattacking champions recently, Chelsea under Conte, Leicester. So we haven't really seen anyone win with this incredible, irreverent, free-flowing build out of the back style. So now he has that and his old, you know, foe Pep to combat and to contend with. Okay. But he also has to deal with, you know, imagine this. Manchester City, your rivals, quote-unquote, for Manchester United, win the title by a mile. And then Liverpool, your actual rivals, win the Champions League final. I mean, if that happens, it's just going to be brutal to be a Manchester United fan right now.
It'll be a long summer.
I'm wondering what happens with this group. Hit me on Twitter at Kyle Martino. I know Manchester United fans are going to hit me up and yell at me again. That's fine. Yeah. But I'm worried. I'm worried about Manchester United because, you know, so far recruitment hasn't worked. And I just wonder if they're really going to be able to recruit the quality of talent they're going to need that will buy into a counterattacking approach, because that's who they're going to be. I mean, that's his DNA. That's how he wins. And you know, can he get Griezmann? I mean, Griezmann does it to a certain extent with Atletico Madrid, but he's allowed to be a striker and have the counterattacking base be behind him to set him up to, and that worked really well with he and Diego Costa in the final of the Europa League. So I don't think, especially when Manchester City is right there.
Yeah.
When you're Antoine Griezmann and you can decide between Barcelona, Real Madrid, or Manchester City, I mean, Manchester United, one of the biggest brands, if not the biggest brand in the world, incredible history, amazing stadium, heritage. Sorry, I didn't mean to throw that in. But so you get why there's a draw. But, man, when you see Pogba and these other guys and Mkhitaryan saying, I needed to leave to play attacking soccer, I don't know how you attract the talent they're going to have to find this summer in order to close that huge gap.
I mean, Griezmann even has come out recently and said he might stay at Atletico.
Yeah.
And if I were him, I'd rather stay at Atletico than go to Manchester United. Barcelona or Manchester City would be another story if he decided to go there. But, you know, you brought up the ostracizing of players and stars, and you mentioned there's been issues with Pogba already, and he might have started another one with Lukaku.
Yes.
Because he came out and criticized him for basically saying he told me he wasn't ready to play, so how can I expect him?
It's crazy
to know how
to
much
me.
He's going to play as a sub. It just, you know, this is the last game of the season that he's going to see these guys, and
it's
going to leave a bad taste in all their mouths as they head off to the World Cup. And who knows what they're all going to do there? They could go on and have success and completely kind of forget about Mourinho, or they'll come back and say, "Why should I listen to you when I've just gone and won a World Cup?" You know, Pogba could go win a World Cup with France. Lukaku could win a World Cup with Belgium. I mean, these are players that can play for some of the
major super clubs coming
contenders.
In after them. Yeah. I mean, here's the thing: don't forget too, the chemistry of players is important. Diego Costa leaving Chelsea was a big deal, and David Luiz and others that were, you know, if you listened and to the little birdie said, really close friends and all these, I mean, that chemistry behind the scenes, you can break it up by treating one player poorly. The problem is Lukaku and Pogba are best friends. I mean, these guys are inseparable, and it seems he's treating both of them poorly. So, you know, these guys are driving in the car together, or they're out at dinner and they're upset about the situation. And ultimately, he said, Lukaku, you know, let us down. You know, he should have played. He should have started. He was the one who said he wasn't fit and healthy enough. Forgetting the fact that he's got a World Cup this summer. I mean, yeah, an FA Cup is important, and if you're healthy, you're going to play. So it was bad management from Jose Mourinho, something that may have worked in the past, but I don't think in the current climate is working for him, those old tricks. But here's the other thing, too, is you crush Rashford all week. You know, two games earlier, you say he's not good enough against Brighton to play, and you basically tell everyone, this is why I don't start this kid, because he's not good enough. And then you need him to start in the FA Cup final. It's just bad management.
Yeah, he definitely looked like a player lacking a lot of confidence. And he had that one chance that he just kind of scuffed at it, and he just looked off.
Yeah. So I mean, real quick on Chelsea, because I kind of flew through this on Manchester United, which we knew I'd do. You know, I think it's amazing that we've all accepted that Antonio Conte was going to leave. I mean, we accepted that. I mean, three months ago.
Probably.
Yeah. I mean, more than that, right? I mean, we talked about it on the preseason pod. I remember saying that the fact that he signed a new contract but not a contract extension was a big red flag for me, and I had them outside the top four in my predictions. Oh, you want to know what? I think I snuck them in and snuck Tottenham out at the last moment. idiot. But I guess I said Liverpool will have a magical season, so I saved myself there, even though I never get these right. But it's amazing how we've accepted that Antonio Conte's leaving. You win the FA Cup. I mean, their dip, nowhere near as bad as the last dip after winning a title, and they had a weaker team this year than they did last year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the other teams strengthened, and they got weaker. So where they finished, I'm not really ultimately all that surprised with where they finished. And getting an FA Cup where they finished with what they spent and what their squad looked like, I think is a average to above average season in terms of that's kind of what you expect. Anything above that, a top four finish and FA Cup would have been a great season.
Yeah, I mean, there's two other ways to look at it. I don't know who Chelsea thinks they can get at this point that would be an upgrade, and vice versa. Yeah. I don't know where Conte could go at this point that would be an upgrade. The Italy job was just taken by Mancini. PSG was taken by Tuchel.
Yeah, Ancelotti, so, I think, just went to Napoli, saw today. I mean, it's...
I don't know where, you know, Arsenal, we were going to get to that a little bit later, but it was obviously just taken by Emery. So,
yeah,
you know, even if Simeone were to leave Atletico, which I don't think he is, because, again, I don't know where he would go.
Yeah.
I don't know what option he would want unless he wanted to take a year off and just wait and see what happens. But
here's the bigger
problem. I think he's better off staying, and same for Chelsea.
I think so too. But here's the bigger problem is Michael Emanuele walked away, the technical director. I mean, the director of football, a guy that's absolutely integral to the system, the department that is going to be have the most pressure on them this summer to go recruit and find players to strengthen this team with. They don't have anyone leading that right now. So Granaskaya, you know, the lieutenant, the number two, the most trusted person under Abramovich, she's basically spearheading something that she hasn't really been responsible for in the past. So not only do you have to find a new manager, but you also have to have a recruitment strategy without someone that ultimately is responsible for that or is going to be moving forward. That's why the Arsenal thing, and maybe we'll use that to transition into the managerial merry-go-round. Let's start with Arsenal, and then we'll get to the other ones. You know, the Arsenal thing, it's one of the reasons I'm so... Is that Ivan Gazidis chiming in I'm about to give him credit. One of the things I'm most impressed with Arsenal is they built the infrastructure behind the scenes before they got their new manager. So Mislintat, a director of football... very experienced with Barcelona for over a decade. You know, they put all of the pieces in place that were necessary to start the recruitment strategy. I mean, Aubameyang and Mkhitaryan, I mean, some of these purchases have already been spearheaded by someone who knew them really well because Mislintat was at Borussia Dortmund. So they've begun this process, this strategy. So they've announced today that Unai Emery is going to be the new coach. I guess I'm not surprised, but a lot of Arsenal fans underwhelmed with that because they've looked down the list of possible candidates and thought, and I agree with this, he wouldn't have been in my top three, but thought, you know, couldn't we have done better? Couldn't we have aimed higher? And I guess you never know. I mean, you don't know the negotiations on, I want to bring in my whole staff. I want to be responsible for recruitment. I want this transfer budget assured. I want this salary. There are so many things that break down conversations. The one big breakdown, because it seems it ended up becoming a binary decision between the big risk of Arteta, which up until the night before, it seemed like Arteta was preparing for this job and thought he was going to get it, or go with safe, experienced hands. And that's what Emery is. I mean, I think it's a good hire. I like the move for myriad reasons that I'll get to. It's just, I wonder if in the coming days we find out how that Arteta thing fell apart.
I think there's been some reports already that he was making demands and he wanted some control, I think, over maybe players coming and stuff, which is a little bit surprising for someone who's never managed before. And like you said, they've got their structure in place.
He wasn't going to... Well, not very smart of Arteta when basically you watched them set up the power structure and the hierarchy and who's responsible for what.
Yeah.
Coming in with demands without the CV... I mean, I don't blame Ivan Gazidis.
Just thought his reputation as a player at the club and that he was just the top assistant for Guardiola was enough that he had the clout, I guess.
But no way. I mean, I was just over at NYCFC practice the other day. I wanted to go see their new facility. And Claudio Reyna, a former teammate and a good friend of mine, I just wanted to see what they built there. And it's fantastic, incredible complex that they have. And I sat on the side talk with Patrick Vieira for a little bit. who's being linked with the Nice job. So we'll see if that happens. Yeah. But Patrick didn't say this to me in the conversation yesterday, but we saw his quotes about Arsenal reached out, but it seemed a token gesture that they weren't. I mean, if they weren't interested in you know, Thierry Henry, who's been coaching with Roberto Martinez at Belgium, with who was at the Arsenal structure with a youth team for a little bit, interested in Patrick Vieira, who's done a great job here, who's been coaching for a while, has experience. I mean, more clout than Arteta would have at Arsenal, more credit in the bank. If they weren't interested in those, I find it hard. I throughout the whole process, I found it hard to believe that they were that interested in Arteta.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing about Emery, too, is, you know, take away, if this appointment had happened 2 years ago, everyone would think it's great.
Yeah, it's he the come PSG off thing that everyone's
and,
all...
And it's, I don't know, you can't really compare PSG to Arsenal with the players that they have.
You can't compare PSG to anyone.
Yeah.
There is no other club on the planet that's apples to apples with PSG. So you have to look at his body of work. And his body of work in La Liga, Valencia and Sevilla, I mean, three Europa League titles in a row with Sevilla. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Valencia one I was even more impressed with because they kept losing huge players. They kept selling star players. And competing, and what I loved was how they would compete. I mean, they were the ones that would press Barcelona at times. I mean, the thing I think, ultimately, if I'm going to distill it down to one thing that I would say, bravo, Ivan Gazidis, you made a great call here, and whoever was involved, is he is strong, Emery is strong, in the one area that is Arsene Wenger's major weakness, and it's preparing for your opponent. So, Arsene Wenger deserves so much credit. Incredible manager. I mean, changed the Premier League, changed Arsenal. Just revolutionary. A vanguard, right? One of his weaknesses was he didn't really work on the team a lot in shape. Without the ball, who we want to be, who our opponent is. I mean, Emery is, like, obsessed. I mean, this guy sent... I mean, this is, like, 10 years ago was sending players home with the flash drives of their opponents, who they're going against. You know, he is a detail-oriented, tactically obsessed coach that looks at every opponent. And this is the modern game. This is how it works. And says, how do we stymie them while maintaining who we are? It's something that's not mutually exclusive. You don't have to be this identity and the philosophy that Arsene Wenger talks about. You know, some of the best games in the end of his tenure were when they didn't really look like Arsenal. Going to Manchester City, going to the Etihad a few seasons ago with Cazorla playing their center of the park and sitting and counterattacking, they were incredible on the day. So, you know, that could be the foundation. And Pep Guardiola is one of the only in the world that will just be their identity every single time. I mean, he's going to be who he's going to be every single game. But I like that Emery is tactically obsessed. And one of his former players, it was great, Joaquin had this quote that I went back and found that's amazing. And this is when Joaquin was playing against him. This is when Sevilla had you know, they were playing in a Europa League semifinal, was at Fiorentina. And afterwards, Emery went up to him and said, you know, we planned for you, and told him the whole tactical analysis. And he said, of course you did. Like, I know, I remember what you like. And this is the Joaquin quote, which is amazing. He said, Emery put on so many videos, I ran out of popcorn. But I mean, that's the one thing out of everything. Are there pros and cons? Of course, but ultimately it's a good call because Arsenal have the tools. They need about three or four signings and they're already working on them. They have that checked, and they need a coach that prepares them for their opponent and who they're going to be without the ball.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point you brought up about the players he lost at Valencia. I think during his time there, he lost David Villa, David Silva and Juan Mata. Yeah. So imagine if he kept those three. But like you said, he went on and he still found, you know, you're never going to challenge Real Madrid and Barcelona for the title for the most. I mean, Atletico's, again, because Simeone's done an amazing job. But you can't, so the fact that he was still able to keep them in the Champions League competitions for that long was pretty impressive. So imagine what he'll do, like you said, with a squad that's already been put in place and hopefully bringing in more players.
So there's lots of managers in and out. We'll just talk about one more. I'm surprised Moyes is leaving West Ham. I mean, I don't think Moyes gets a better opportunity, but it seems like it wasn't their choice or wasn't his choice. Yeah. It seems like West Ham were like, thanks, but no thanks. Mm-hmm. And they bring in Pellegrini. So this is a fascinating one because successful, you have to say successful in the Premier League. Even though most would say with Manchester City and the resources and what he had, he should have accomplished more. I don't buy that. He was successful in the Premier League. Yeah. The reason he was successful in the Premier League was recruitment was excellent. I mean, his teams, especially Strike Forces, I mean, he had the Balotelli, Tevez, Dzeko. I mean, wasn't it a I mean, at one point he had a like three or four like starting strikers that were proven goal scorers in the Premier League. I can't remember what the rotation was.
I don't know if he had. I think Balotelli might have left by then, but he had Dzeko.
Wasn't Balotelli? I think there for his. Because Balotelli was Mancini, there for Mancini. And then I think he was a carryover. Maybe he wasn't. But anyway, Aguero, of course. And
Dzeko, like you said, he was there for the
Dzeko.
He had Negredo. Negredo came in that
Negredo,
first season.
Who was a beast, yeah. At least the first half of that season.
He was huge that title-winning season, yeah.
So recruitment in key areas, excellent. I mean, West Ham recruitment has been, save for Arnautovic, who's a left-winger-ish, who's been playing a false nine. I mean, they're, at the striker position, they have really, really struggled. I mean, 15 strikers have auditioned for that role, and Andy Carroll kind of still continues to hang around. Yeah. I mean, Lanzini, there are some good pieces there, but man, does that group need an overhaul. And so I just think Mancini is going to, and West Ham are going to have a bit of a wake-up call here. Pellegrini are going to have a bit of a wake-up call here because Pellegrini hasn't dealt with a squad like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the groups he's had in the past, his 4-2-2-2 that he loves to play, no chance with the group he has now.
Well, and he came out and said he only knows one way to play, and that's to play an attacking style.
Good luck with that group.
It just kind of goes back to a lot of these clubs trying to become a little more ambitious with hiring a manager like this and try to play this attractive style. We've seen other clubs like, you know, I guess Southampton's try to do it. And, you could say Crystal Palace tried to do it at the start of this season with De Boer, and they scrapped that plan pretty quickly. So
this sounds like a great hire.
It sounds like, yes, it does.
But, this could be a big mistake.
Yeah,
yeah. So we'll see. Time will tell. That's the other high profile managerial hiring. So fascinating what's going on there with guys in, guys out. Let's move on to the World Cup. Every time I mention the World Cup, I simultaneously get so excited and so depressed at the same time. It's kind of like, it reminds me of Forgetting Sarah Marshall, where he goes to Hawaii. And it's like, he's in Hawaii, and it's just beautiful, it's gorgeous, and he's trying to learn how to surf, but your ex-girlfriend's there who just dumped you, and it's just like, you can't really enjoy it. That's what I feel like with this World Cup. Because if it wasn't the U.S., it was going to be Italy as a dual citizen, but I don't even have Italy in the World Cup, so I'm struggling. And it's funny, all these like ads about, you know, who you're going to support. I love that. I mean, who are you going to support? Who's the team that you're going to follow?
My mom was born in Argentina, so Argentina's my dad was born in Ecuador, so they didn't make it either. Yeah. So U.S. and Ecuador both out, but I've still got Messi. He's my one hope.
I always have an eye on Argentina. Yeah. And a World Cup. I've talked about it on the pod a lot. I just grew up watching, you know, Boca and River and Independiente and all the Argentine players and Ortega and Verón and Riquelme and Caniggia and Batistuta. I mean, over the years, it's just been incredible. Mm-hmm. So I'll have an eye on them for sure. I'll watch Belgium. You know, just so much talent.
Yeah.
And also a dark horse, I think. I mean, yet to prove themselves against the real world powers, but definitely
And this is the first time I think we can say this is not the young, up-and-coming Belgium squad. These guys are all in their prime now. This is the time they need to make a statement.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I mean they're great. They're great teams. They're great teams to watch. The team that I'm going to watch, I'm going to throw out, is the team I think is they're going to win it, which is not a popular choice, but my choice is France. I think that I just watching this group lately through qualifying, some of their friendlies. I mean, Pogba has a chip on his shoulder. I mean, if you look at the group that didn't go, I mean, the guys that didn't make this squad, I mean, Lacazette and, you know, we talked about Martial and Rabiot, and I mean, that's a deep, very talented group.
Yeah.
I'm loving them. I'm liking their chances.
Yeah. It's surprising they don't get mentioned as high up as
Germany and Brazil.
Because they really do, they might be the most complete of all of them. Like, you could look at Brazil and say they look a little weak at back. You could look at Germany. It's like, who's really going to play up top for them and score? Mm. Who can they really rely on to score goals with Klose finally not out? But like,
it's weird to see a World Cup without Klose.
Yeah, I know. But you look at France. I mean, top to bottom, it's hard to find a weakness.
They also are versatile because they have hybrid player. You know, they have Pogba playing a bit of a hybrid position. They have Griezmann playing a bit of a hybrid position. Mm-hmm. They have Giroud, who's come on and started to really, you know, perform and show what he can do on a consistent basis. So they've got players hitting good form at the right time. The players that aren't like Pogba have relief being there to show themselves, express themselves. And listen, if he really wants to go, And if Raiola has been shopping him around, as Pep Guardiola said, saying he offered him at Manchester City, then he needs that tournament to perform well if he wants the fee that it's going to take to pry him away from Manchester United. But you know, let's just finish with the depressing side of it, of the U.S. not being there. And, you know, what's interesting is two people culpable who refuse to take any responsibility whatsoever, Bruce Arena and Jurgen Klinsmann. Yeah. I mean, quotes recently basically saying, yeah, nothing was wrong when I was doing it. Mm-hmm. Well, both of you guys made mistakes. If I could point to individual games, you know, obviously Trinidad and Tobago, but I could take from their tenure just one game and point to so many mistakes that they made in those games. So, of course, both of them are culpable. You know, the bigger problem is just really the mess behind the scenes with U.S. soccer, and I saw it during the election. Yeah. And, you know, the current president, Carlos Cordero, listen, I wish him luck. I'm not the type of person to get so emotional and competitive about it where I lose and I want the person to not succeed. Of course I want him to do well. His focus is primarily on the World Cup bid, which is in jeopardy. I mean, Morocco's bid is not as strong as the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. The tri bid is the strongest out there. Technically, all the grounds that you really look at, the capital it can bring, it will be the most successful World Cup ever. I mean, 1994 still is the highest attended World Cup of all time. So it's going to be about, you know, just the politics and all that. So he's away doing that. But while he's doing that, there's just no real change on the technical front. These GM positions that they're trying to hire on the men's side, on the women's side, I've spoken with some of the candidates. You know, they're a bit underwhelmed with the position because the scope of work, the position is so narrow. It seems to just be, and they didn't say this. This is my opinion. A bit of a scapegoat position where it's just not the GM roles aren't being given by job description enough authority to affect the technical landscape of the entire group, so that the pipeline feeding you players at the first team level, at the full national team, you know how a player's been prepared. You've been involved with the thought process and the strategy. It's really disjointed. I mean, there is real no clear strategy, no clear organization. And I mean, it really still just concerns me daily because we're going to sit here on the couches this summer and watch a World Cup without the U.S. men in it. And it was avoidable.
Well, and this, you know, you brought up some of the quotes that Arena and Klinsmann have been saying. And you can't really blame anyone at U.S. soccer for trying to control what these guys say once they've been let go. But you do have to question why they want to say these things. Like, what are they trying to prove? I mean, Bruce Arena's going to have a whole book come out.
Yes, coming out summer.
And, you know, one of the things he brought up was that he could have, or that they had approached him before the Copa America about replacing.
They did. Klinsmann. Yeah, so I knew this during the election.
I just don't see the point of, what's the point of bringing that up even? I mean.
Yeah, so listen, a lot of people share your opinion. A lot of people are kind of like, Bruce, you know, we don't want to hear it. It's sour grapes. Go away in your corner. I don't like that because, listen, you can say Bruce made a mistake, shouldn't have been the person that U.S. soccer hired. The comments are arrogant, they're out of touch, they're tone deaf. You can say all of those things, but still say this is the most successful U.S. coach of all time. He has an intimate knowledge of a lot of the issues behind the scenes. And listen, we all know there are issues behind the scenes. We went 4 years without an open election. So I just would tell people, you can have your anger, you can have your resentment, but it's a bit of a Tokoki fallacy to say, well, it's because you're saying it, that sort of ad hominem approach where, no, well, you did this. So, like, even though what you're saying is important and I should be listening to it, I won't because of who you are. I mean, that's dangerous because what he's ultimately trying to do, and it could be self-serving to sell a book, Jurgen Klinsmann, it could be to protect an image, it can be whatever the agenda is. You have to be able to sift through that and say, is this important to pay attention to because we're seeing catastrophic mistakes? Like, we're seeing a cataclysmic error in terms of the U.S. men failing to qualify for the World Cup. We still see the women not being paid the same amount, not being given the same facilities, the same fields. We still see a pay-to-play structure that's getting more expensive at the youth level. We still see an exodus of kids out of the game. I mean, the Aspen Institute came out with another study of participation and our sports down again. So All the numbers that you can't argue are there to tell us something's wrong with the way things are being governed and the design of the machine. Bruce is coming in to say, I've seen actually who's doing the designing and how they design it and what they thought. Here it is. Take it for what it's worth. I think that's what people need to do is to just listen, hear it,
Yeah.
And then don't discredit it based on who it's coming from. I that's just based on everything right now in our echo chambers, outside of sport and everything. I mean, people just have their opinion and that's all they want. You know, it's important that we listen to everyone and we have discourse and we have conversations. And then you can still say, you shouldn't have been the coach. And yeah. I'm really mad that you screwed up in Trinidad. I mean, you can do that too.
No, yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, I think part of it looks like he's saying these things maybe to deflect some of the attention away to why they failed while he was coach, because maybe if he had taken over earlier, they wouldn't have had those issues in those first couple games against Mexico.
But, like, think about that. So, like, yeah, listen, maybe so, maybe not. Mm-hmm. I mean, he only lost two games in what, like 15 or 16 that he coached. Mm-hmm. So the margin was tiny by the time he got the job, but he's culpable 100%. Yeah. He's not taking responsibility for that. But here's the thing is, his story is a really important one. This is true. And I knew this during the election. It was my story to tell. Players were upset with the way they were being treated, and listen, some play that always happens under any manager, but chemistry was struggling, the group was struggling, the results were clear that the team wasn't performing. Yeah. So there was an issue. Finally, Sunil Gulati and Dan Flynn took notice of it and talked to individual players and asked their opinion and did their due diligence and realized this is going from bad to worse. Whoever's fault that is, forget it, but they recognized there was a diminishing return situation. Mm-hmm. They approached Bruce Arena and basically came to a verbal agreement saying, okay, we're going to hire you. This is before Copa America, right? We're going to hire you, and we'll iron out the details in a week or so. They had approached LA Galaxy. I mean, everyone knew about this in a small circle, and they kept it private, right? So Dan Flynn goes in for an operation, and fortunately ends up being a really successful operation that improves his health. But simply because Dan Flynn is taken out of the decision in a two-man panel,
Gulati
basically.
Didn't want to make that decision.
Yeah, Gulati didn't want the pressure of executing this himself when he was the one that spearheaded and pushed to get Klinsmann to begin with. Yeah. So forget right decision, wrong decision, all that stuff. A structure, where we're talking about a $1 billion decision here, a structure that has hundreds of employees, technical people all over the place with the nous and the ability to understand the nuance of this decision, the importance of this decision, were not involved in this. It was two guys without the technical nous to be making a decision this big, two guys that should be involved in the decision for sure, but should not be making it unilaterally. They dragged their feet until the margin was so small that Bruce Arena couldn't afford to lose two games. Yeah. And so the blame is spread around, but an organization that's built where one person's not available and a decision of that size isn't executed for half a year, that's a failed system. I mean, something's wrong there. And then the U.S. Soccer Board of 15 to 17 people who are supposed to be involved in these macro decisions had absolutely no idea how Klinsmann was hired, how he's fired, how Bruce was hired. They admitted after the fact they needed to hold a special meeting to figure this stuff out. I mean, that's just – so Bruce is trying to shed a little more light and show us what it looks like behind the curtain.
Yeah.
And listen, I'm not going to tell you what to do. Don't listen to it if you don't want to listen to it. But I think we need to hear everyone out and then unemotionally decide what's good for soccer in this country moving forward.
I guess it's the bigger picture for me when I see all this stuff. Like, you know, Bedoya had some quotes come out saying, you know, he kind of is questioning Bruce. He said, Jurgen was always challenging you. He pushed and tested you, and maybe some people can't handle that as well as others. I think that was a problem. So he's kind of I think criticizing Arena there, but also criticizing his teammates. Mm-hmm. And then he said, you know, they became too reliant on Pulisic, which I think is actually probably a good point.
Yeah.
And then Pulisic came out recently and said, you know, they just weren't focused, which is fine. You know, that's actually not. I think that's a fair quote to say. Mm-hmm. But again, he's kind of criticizing his teammates, and you could say criticizing Arena. And I guess, you know, you can go back to when Pulisic wrote the Players Tribune article. Jeff Cameron wrote a Players Tribune article. Jermaine Jones had the Instagram story.
Yeah.
And maybe this is the best way they feel they need to share their views.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wonder, you have all these voices talking. Is there a way that they could do this more privately where it doesn't come out publicly?
As players.
As the players and as the managers. Again, these guys are – Klinsmann and Arena are kind of out of the picture now. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, as players, that they should try and – talk with, whether it's with the players themselves or with people that are part of U.S. Soccer, because when you see all these quotes, all these different people coming out and having their own take and their own say, it just kind of goes to what you're saying. It highlights the dysfunction, I think, that's going on in U.S. soccer. And I wonder if there's a better way where they can keep this a little more private and internal.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the modern day you can't, you know, with podcasts and Instagram and Twitter and articles. I mean, there's just so much content, and they're getting hit up constantly for their opinions. So, I mean, to deny it and have no comment, it creates in that negative space an area for people to make their own opinion and assessment and guess on what was going on. It's clear something was broken. It's clear something was toxic. So I think it's just important to understand, you know, this is just an individual's opinion. I played for some people that thought Bruce was awful, and I thought he was one of the best coaches I've ever had. I mean, that, you know, individual players are going to respond differently, but it's clear whatever was going wrong is not on one person. And it's also what was going wrong took a while to become a toxic environment. And at that point, it was going to be hard to arrest it and fix things in the short term. Bruce Arena was a short-term, very nearsighted fix. Whether you thought that was the right fix or not, that was not a let's get this culture good for the next 10 years. It was a let's go back to what worked in the past, even if that was the wrong strategy.
Yeah.
So ultimately what I think is discourse is good. I mean, I think it's okay to disagree with people, to have opinions that others don't share. It's just how it's expressed. And, you know, when it's these attacks, when it's this expose style thing, I mean, leave that to the journalist. You know, if you're a player, just offer your background or your opinion on something that you care about that can help, that can move the program forward. Mm-hmm. But the pointing finger stuff, you know, I mean, I just think once it feels like people pointing fingers, ultimately it shuts you off. You're just thinking, someone's looking for someone to blame.
Yeah.
And there's so many people to blame in this one that it's hard to isolate it to one tiny group. But ultimately, we're going backwards.
Yeah.
That's clear. We're going backwards, whether it's the men or the women, we're going backwards. And players on the team will tell you it. Players that played for the team will tell you it. Players and coaches and pundits, they all see it. We need to really just put on our you know, big boy pants and be able to have hard discussions to do an audit of where we are, give credit for the things that have worked, really be honest about the things that aren't. And that's it.
That's a good point. I mean, I guess we can try and end this on a positive note. The roster was just released for their friendly against Bolivia, right?
Yeah, a bunch of young kids.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the average age is below 23.
I love it.
So, yeah, I was going to, what are your thoughts overall?
I love that because what? I mean, is a Gold Cup is our first competitive game in 2000?
You know, next summer.
Yes.
Over a year away.
So we are at that crucial point. I mean, look at England, you know, with the roster they have. I mean, a lot of teams have their transition year going on right now where they're taking a lot of people that aren't, you know, don't have double-digit caps and don't have World Cup experience. I mean, this is a transition era right now for, I mean, the Clint Dempseys, the Michael Bradleys, the Tim Howards, the Landon Donovans. I mean, we're leaving a big group that have been huge for us for a long time. So instead of just trying to prolong the careers of guys that you know you're not going to depend on the next World Cup cycle, get these guys ready. Get them blooded. The only thing I'll say is it's okay to fail. I mean, we have to be okay with going and losing some of these games and getting crushed or getting wiped out to get these kids experience. But what needs to happen is we need to just commit to something, commit to a philosophy, commit to a style, and then it's just clear what we're trying to accomplish over the next two cycles. So that's what's absent. I love the young player. Give them a chance. Let's unearth the great talent. These kids deserve opportunities. There's some great players in there. It's a good showcase in these big tournaments to get them to bigger clubs and to really jumpstart their careers. I love all of that. But if it's not plugged into a overall technical strategy on who we're going to be as a soccer nation. And listen, that evolves. I mean, we're a very complex soccer nation that you can't really say, here's who we are, here's who we're going to be. That's the beauty of who we are. And I don't think we've been a melting pot enough. I don't think we've been multicultural and kind of organic enough, moving in and out of different identities and philosophies. But we don't really have one other than this like default, you know, hard to play against blue collar direct thing that we go back to from time to time. So I just want someone to go in there who has the experience, who has the relationships, who has the emotional intelligence, the network, the respect to say, here's who we're going to be over the next two World Cup cycles. Everything we do is based on becoming this, mm-hmm. and we'll show you how we're going to do it. That's what I'm longing for.
When do you think they'll make the final decision on who's going to be the next head coach?
It seems like they want the GM thing sorted out beforehand, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. Yeah. From the conversations I've had with people that have interviewed, the role doesn't seem – it's not appealing to the caliber of person they should be hiring. Because the caliber of person they're going to be looking at who would really move the needle and do this job well has a great job right now. I mean, those people are hired in good roles, good high-paying roles. And listen, this is probably going to be a high-paying role. But if it's just to be a figurehead, no one I know that's going to do this job well is interested in that.
Yeah.
And so we'll see.
And there's no rush, I guess, at least on the head coaching position, because like you said, they don't have any competitive
matches.
You
wanted to end on a positive note. I always find a way to make it pessimistic? I feel like I always find a way to like turn it into a pretty sour thing. So I'm sorry, Tad Pals. I love you guys so much. Thanks for listening this whole season. We're going to take a little break. I'll see you out at the bars, PJ and MJ. We're going to be, I always say MJ.
Yeah.
I just want them to be MJ. Producer Mike and producer Rory, we're gonna be out. We're gonna be around. We're gonna be going to games and we're gonna be at bars. So come up to us because we're fans this summer.
I won't be at bars. Well, maybe in Moscow.
You've got to work. Still.
I actually have to work. I'll be working.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Sorry to remind you. So have a fun summer, you guys. Enjoy the World Cup. It's gonna be a blast. Argentina is gonna make PJ proud, and my France prediction. We'll see what happens there. But regardless of what happens in the World Cup, guys, see you next Premier League season. Stay on your feet.